Unsee the future. The Hopi Chatty Bits. Hello and welcome to an Unsee the Future Hopi Chatty Bits kind of special. On the back of Bournemouth Writing Festival 2023, I am Timo Peach. I shall be your host for the next hour, I guess. Introducing, well, as I like to on this show, artists, solar punks and change makers reimagining the stories we think we're in. I'm coming to you, of course, from the middle of the south coast of the UK, in which today, summer just turned up. Like that. Suddenly it's warm. I've had the studio door open. All the flowers are out. We've just come into June here, and in the northern hemisphere, it's looking jolly, summery and sweet. Welcome to you if you're watching from Bournemouth Writing Festival. If we met, it was lovely to meet you. If we haven't yet at that festival, I hope we do on the thread here tonight and subsequently. And why are we here for this particular special? Well, I, of course, threw out a challenge in my keynote at the festival, and it was to write a solar punk story. And if you were there, you'll know that I explained a little bit what that's like. It's a positive speculative fiction. The challenge I set out to a room full of writers was, you do it. You might not think you're a science fiction author. Bring your voice and your heart and your experience to the idea of writing a future that isn't a total disaster. Because how else do we write the new songs and stories of us? So first of all, I'd like to introduce the festival director, Dominic Wong. Dominic, welcome to the show. Now, it's a kind of casual show tonight. Welcome to Unsee the Future.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So you are the brainwave behind Bournemouth Writing Festival. It was a great success for a first ever year, and I felt extremely welcome. What did you make of having all those writers together, just in general genres? What was it like having all those creatives in one place?
Well, we all know that writing is a lonely business. You know, by definition, writing is a lonely business. And I think the thing that we wanted to do was create a community to let other people know that there's people like you all around you, not just in, you know, not just within Bournemouth or down the road or in Dorset or further afield, even digitally. And, you know, what we wanted to create was a hive mind, if you like, of writers to know that there's people out there that will motivate you, that give you inspiration to encourage you. And our central ethos of the Writing Festival is to inspire writers to write. And this challenge has, as we're about to see, inspired writers to write, which is fantastic.
It really was a great format to speak to people with the kind of message that I've got with the book, The Place of Art, I think central to saving the frickin' world, because it's all a cultural state of mind that we're in that drives all our value systems. So there's nothing we need more than new ways of seeing, new stories of us, new ideas to inhabit and test into. So actually it felt almost like a strange revelation to me to be stood in front of a load of writers saying that. And it does seem to have got people's interest piqued in lots of different ways.
Yeah. And I think, the way we designed the festival, that it wasn't elitist. It wasn't, oh, I've written or I've studied writing. You know, it was the whole spectrum of, even if you've just begun to write or even thinking about writing, to being a more seasoned pro who's maybe had something published and wanting to keep writing and finding the stimulus to write. We did a networking event a few weeks ago on a boat in Poole Harbour. And in fact, one person came along and they hadn't even started to write yet. They just had this idea or this feeling inside that they wanted to write, and maybe this was the place to start that and to meet different people and to be inspired to do that. So it's great to, you know, we all write. You know, some people say, I can't write, but you tweet, you write emails, you know, you write a shopping list, whatever it might be. It's just crafting it into something, artsy, you might say, Timo. So I think, what came out of the festival really was that people that want to write can write. We just need to give them that impetus and that purpose to write.
Yes, amen. And it's all practice. Even if you have a natural instinct and talent to go with it, which is a very handy coincidence, even then you still need to practice to get confident marks. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, anyone can get better, and all of us have to try and make sense of the worlds of emotion within us. So this is, both of us, I know, would say, Dom, this is a call to any human being at all. You are creative. Join in and have a go. Let's create safe spaces where people feel that they can.
That's right. And the idea is to write, you know, and you're not going to get it right first time, probably. You might do, you might not. But the idea, you're right, is practice. But it's also having the encouragement and the motivation. And, you know, sometimes it's, you know, well, you know, I've done the first draft, so they think it's very good. Or my friend read it, they didn't really like it. But okay, it doesn't matter. You've started that process. Okay, even if that goes in the bin, the idea is that you've started the process, you've started your journey, and who knows where it's going to go to. Maybe you just need that spark. As what we said, the motivation, the inspiration, the stimulus, whatever it is. So, for example, we did, during the festival, we did writing on the beach. And the idea was that, you know, take your shoes and socks off and you know, let the environment around you stimulate your creativity. So whether that's, you know, what does it feel like to have the breeze going through your hair or the salt on your lips or the sand grains on your toes? You know, those are the things that we need. Those are the sparks I was talking about to get people writing.
It's a sensory, full sensory experience we're supposed to be in all the time. That's what we're built for. And very often our experiences in the modern world are extremely, well, they're boxed up in every way, but also in our senses. We've fired things at the eyes the whole time, and context is removed and multisensoriality is removed. And that's part of the shift going on all around us to healthier futures, which art can help walk people into and kind of cut out a lot of the wondering about it. But if there's one thing I think we're all trying, I was going to say, if there's one thing we're all trying to sort out internally, there's this background hum inside and all around us about the future, a topic that we don't talk about in modern culture at all. We've been frozen, I would say, for 40 years, and we daren't talk about it. Politicians, writers, musicians, I think that's just at last beginning to change. My challenge at the end of my keynote that you so kindly invited me into at the end of the festival, quite symbolically in a way, was let's all have a go. Let's call it a safe space. And people have responded. So tonight we're going to look at, I think, probably four different stories that people have written in. And I'd like to invite our first two guests that have joined us online into the space to join us for a free chat. We'll look at some of the things that they've been doing. If you are watching this at home or wherever you are live and not on the recording of it, then do feel free to jump into the comments and share what your experiences have been from home. If you've had a go at this or even just been thinking, what does solar punk even mean? How do I do it? But to kick off the conversation, I want to invite friends of mine, Simon and Lee. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Good evening.
Whereabouts in the world are you both?
Go on, Sam.
Round and about Exeter, essentially, yeah. I'm more central Exeter, and Lee, you are?
A bit more south towards the coast, near the River Ex.
Very lovely. We're all lucky to live, all four of us here currently on the call. We are lucky to live along the south coast of England. It's got both ends of where we are beautiful.
And but we're connected. I've noticed that Dominic has the other end of my network cable hanging from the ceiling.
Yes, indeed. And it's the Jurassic cable, I think you'll find, that where you are with where we are.
Jurassic cable.
write that down, someone.
Quick, get that book out.
So, guys, I know that you're no strangers to writing. Of course, when you say no strangers to, you have to sing it, don't you? You're no strangers to writing. We know the rules and we break them. It's been a long day. The warmth has got to me already. No, focus, Peach. You're hosting this live. You guys are writers and creatives in lots of ways, and I don't want to sort of make others feel a bit sort of weird, because you are quite practiced as writers. But even you two, as practiced creatives and science fiction fans and creators, even you did each say to me, I don't know whether I can do solar punk. Which is interesting. Talk me first through, maybe Simon, start with you. What was your approach to this? And were you a bit daunted by the idea of this? And if so, why?
I was daunted in as much as when you do your research and you look into the people that have already written solar punk, they just seem so knowledgeable. There seems to be a lot of research to be done into things that haven't happened yet.
Yeah.
So it really is a case of taking a step back and saying, right, what do I personally get out of this? And what I found was that it's an extremely broad palette, really.
Yeah.
For me as a writer, it's always about the human connection. It's always about the characters.
Yeah.
So when I started thinking about that and thinking about a central character and maybe what's their attitude towards the solar punk elements, then I start getting my story. But that's me making it sound easier than it was, because it wasn't. It was a case of thinking, how on earth do I fit into all this, and how do I create a new future? So, I mean, I'll talk some more in a bit, but, you know, for me, it was a case of maybe stepping back in the chronology and maybe coming a little bit closer to now.
Interesting. So I wonder how that sounds to somebody who doesn't follow science fiction and thinks, I'm nothing to do with sci-fi. It's not for me. How does what you've described differ from other writing you've done plenty of in a science fiction mold? How is solar punk different to that?
Sorry about the background noise.
Just to jump in there. Thank you for the extra Foley there, Lee, by the way, just to bring alive the multi-sensory experience.
I utterly love my wife. I said, we're doing a podcast. This picks up my heartbeat. Please be really quiet. Sounds like she's just unloaded a bricks in the front yard. Anyway, what's the question?
No, the question was to Simon. Simon, sorry. How did it differ for you in your head, solar punk to other sci-fi?
I mean, the vast majority of things that I've written are science fiction and fantasy. But even though it's made me realize, I always thought that I was a proper sci-fi nerd and I love fantastical things that were completely detached from reality. But I found myself tethering myself more to it because it was that much more personal.
Yeah.
It felt like I wanted to talk about our attitudes towards it. And I wanted to talk about how maybe a lot of us are thinking about this thing and how we fit into it, and also the frustrations that we feel people aren't thinking the same way. That's where I was coming from.
It's much closer to home, isn't it? There are consequences now, which is a great abstract idea for writing. Characters should have consequences. But when you're the character and we're already living in 2023 and it's got some very futuristic problems, that's interesting that it's closer to home. There are more consequences. You're more invested. Lee, did you find the idea of solar punk a challenge, even with your massive intersectional mind?
Yeah, I did, actually. I mean, I'm massively into science and science fact. And I've been reading a lot more science and science fact in the last decade than ever before. And what's coming, the graphene kind of revolution, all that sort of thing, really exciting stuff. Yeah. But things are changing at such a pace. And like Simon, I looked at a few other solar punk stories and the kind of the ethos behind it and the images that people are producing, which are really helpful. And they're beautiful and they're really lovely. And it's a very utopian future, even though that word shouldn't really be used in solar punk, I suppose, but it's quite utopian. And it's quite hard to get from now to there without, like Simon said, doing some research. And then all of a sudden, as a writer, you feel a little bit constricted because you think, well, hang on, I can't just have them riding a bike. They have to ride a type of bike. So what kind of bike is it? And then you break the entire thing down. You're there forever trying to be a scientist. And then you think, well, if I've got the science wrong, someone's going to pick up on me and then shoot me down and flame. So you can't have a future like this. That bike would never hover or whatever. So it was quite restricting. But what I did was I went a slightly different direction and thought, well, do you know what? I just want a bit of fun. I like characters, and I like Simon. I start with a character and think about what sort of person they are. And I used a 13-year-old girl. That's quite a good age as well, because it's age of discovery. And, you know, you've already got 13 years in the background of something. So all our kids are used to iPads and, you know, technology and mobile phones. They don't know a time before that. We do. So I've got adults in it that knows the time a little bit before the 13-year-old. The 13-year-old lives in that time now, so she doesn't see anything as not normal or not different to what it was before. So that's a good starting point. That meant I had to kind of build a small world around this character. And the place I went to, believe it or not, was Studio Ghibli, because it seems to me have touched solar punk for so long now without even the solar punk it didn't have a name, but it was there because it's such a lovely, interesting world that they designed, that it's the polar opposite of the cyberpunk thing, which is what we were talking about, you know, It's very dark and distressing. And there's a lot of anime coming from Japan and that sort of thing. But Studio Ghibli don't do that. They do very hopeful and very strange and odd and naturally interactive with technology type films.
It's naturalistic, and yes, yours does feel that way, your story. And they do have a sort of sense, nature is an ever-present character. And I think because it's anime, there is that extra dimension to us as Anglophones watching Japanese storytelling. We can imbue it very easily with a sense of spirit of others, something a bit extra than just a nice backdrop, a bit more than just place as character. You can sense a spirit of nature somehow in an awful lot of Ghibli stuff. So that's interesting you reference that. Dominic, I want to ask you, speaking as the, in a way, you're speaking as the everyman from the festival. You're representing a totally wide genre of writers. What's your relationship as a writer been with science fiction? How have you viewed it? Have you read any sci-fi? What's your sort of take on it from a distance?
I've only really read Arthur C. Clarke, to be honest with you, in terms of sci-fi, and I'm not a big fan of sci-fi movies. But what's really interesting to what you said, Lee, you know, when I think about sci-fi, you know, you kind of go back to the cultural icons of Star Wars and the Jetsons even. And it's interesting what you said, Lee, about the bike and how you wanted to have, it's not a bike, but a type of bike. And it reminded me of Timo's talk where he said about, you know, we're still regurgitating stories from 500 years ago. It's still the same stories, but, you know. So, you know, like if we were to, you know, was it Henry Ford said, you know, if you did research groups on, you know, when he was developing the car, if you did research groups and asked customers what they wanted, they would all say a faster horse, because that's the frame. That's what people's frame of reference, people's minds. So, I suppose when I was thinking about solarpunk, I was thinking of almost like the difference between a horse to a car. You know, so if you were to say, you know, to somebody in that world, like, you know, we're going into the future, well, it's just a horse with wheels on or something like that, I don't know, or a horse with six legs, rather than coming out of something completely different.
So You're right. It's not a bike. It's boots that are magnetic, that travel along a magnetic track. It's much better. Thank you.
I like that. Yes.
But I suppose that, you know, how do we, you know, and Lee, you're saying about, you know, but it's not believable if I was to have that kind of thing, you know, will scientists come up to me? And what's interesting, I think, when people write sci-fi or write anything which is outside of their genre, and you know, I'm reading a book now about this person that's plagiarized somebody's book on historical fiction, you know, and how do they write it but, you know, and but still be believable. So I suppose my question back to you, Lee, or to all people writing sci-fi, is how do you get away from our current terms of reference, i.e. iPads or cars, into something which is completely sci-fi / solarpunk, which is quite to the extremes of believability, and maybe even suspending belief of, is that scientifically possible? Because I think, you know, going back to Timo's thing of, you know, we're still having the same stories of 500 years. I think when people think of an alien, they think of, you know, a green kind of slimy form with maybe three or four eyes. That's just a human interpretation of an alien. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Lee, that's a, well, and Simon, both of you, how do we get away from the references of the time we're in? Can we?
And do we want to?
Simon?
Personally, I find it harder than I realise. I think we need those. I mean, we're storytellers at the end of the day, and it's just another filter. It's just another medium by which to create these, I guess it's a way of getting us, our brains working in another way, which we find exciting, but equally referencing our lives and being able to touch on subject matter that we may not be able to otherwise. As far as the believability, I mean, the most successful science fiction, I think, or even fantasy, is where everything ties up, where it makes sense within its own world.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the secret to successful world building. I think it's something that I think I need to practice more of.
Well,
Lee, we've been telling stories for such a long time as a race, and the play, the actual play Okay, we had a blip there. Solar flare, maybe? We go back to the ancient Greeks and... go back to the ancient Greeks and you have, you know, somebody basically giving some kind of a diatribe and there's some dancers behind him and he's just talking. And then suddenly somebody has the great idea of turning two people and talking to each other, which I think, Timo, you might have touched upon.
And, I might have touched on that in a toga.
In a toga. And then they turn around and they're facing the audience. And they're, oh, that's a good idea, isn't it? So, you know, the stories that are there, the Greek tragedies, the love and all that, you know, these plots have been going for thousands of years. We're never really going to get anything brand new ever. It's just the way in which you start twisting your stories to fit in with whatever it is you want to tell. So, you know, if we're telling a story about the future, you can, you know, like you've been saying, you can choose any variant of a future because it hasn't happened yet. Yeah. So it is sci-fi is a funny old thing. The more you get into it, it's like anything at all, the more strands you suddenly get into. Okay, there isn't one kind of rock. There's about 50,000 different versions of rock. There isn't one kind of dance music. There's 50,000 different types of dance music. There isn't one kind of science fiction. There's lots of different types of science fiction and ways of telling those stories. And it's whatever you prefer, but where you go. The thing about the iPad, that's going to disappear. We're going to have things directly implanted into our heads. We may not even need any of that. It might be just an organic way of talking to people and touching people. You just don't know what's going around the corner. These things are very hardware, but it might be software, wetware, and all that sort of thing in the future. Things that we're, as humans, we are walking computers. So, you know, it's kind of thinking almost too far ahead sometimes. When you read 3001 A Space Odyssey, that's a really good example of Arthur C. Clarke trying to see where we are 1,000 years ahead. It's almost so weird you can't even begin to fathom what's going on.
You know, for me, science fiction actually embodies a key principle of art. In that because it is a what if, it's what if this were true? What if this had extended out? It's a bit like going into a white cube gallery. Some of us feel drawn to go in there because we love a little bit of culture. Some of us feel drawn to spaceships or really overt sort of space opera stuff just to escape. And others of us think, oh, I'd never go into a white cube gallery or I'd never watch a sci-fi thing. It's not for me. But were you to be drawn into one, it can have a strange effect on the way you see the world. I come out of art galleries always looking at everything differently. Is that art? Is that a thing? Because you're made to look at it in a whole new way, deliberately. And that's what science fiction's doing. It is saying, imagine this was upside down, or that one thing in society were like that. And you can't help but come away a little bit changed. I think that's its great power.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, Simon, you know, what you said about, you know, immersing yourself in the world, you know, if the writer is clever enough to be able to immerse yourself into that world, then, you know, you can suspend belief quite easily. And, you know, when you were talking, I kind of, my mind went to Avatar and even Finding Nemo. And I remember, you know, watching Finding Nemo for the first time and my wife was saying, this is stupid. You know, that fish will never escape from that aquarium. And I was thinking, we're talking about talking fish. And I think, you know, and, you know, particularly in poetry, I saw that Abby's joined us on YouTube as well.
Yeah.
You know, the poets in a very short amount of time or very few words can really envelop us into a world. And then, you know, and I suppose if the art is that good, we can just suspend belief and, you know, forget about the mechanics of whether that's, you know, whether that physically possible, you know, the nitpickers, you know, will go into that. But I suppose as with art, you know, you could nitpick art to its nth degree, but actually if you just take a step back and just be immersed, I think it's, and that's the skill of writers.
It is the skill of writers. And also there's a taste element there that we all, as the boys would tell you, we all know as sci-fi nuts that we all draw the lines in very different places. And half the fun of science fiction, exactly like music, is bickering about which is the better sort of science fiction or story. And that it all, just like music, comes down to emotional conviction. But coming back to your point, Simon, there's much more at stake in a solar punk story because we're daring to look at a world that we're a hair's breadth away from. Usually solar punk is a fairly near future thing. And it's all on the line. What happens once we're old or we've only just died as a generation? What are our children and their children dealing with? Oh, that's a lot to organize. And on that note, I'm going to bring in our next guest to just join the conversation. Andy.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. Yeah. Andy, welcome to the team. You know half the gang.
Yes, I do. Yes, very well. Yeah.
And you also shared a story. We haven't yet got into each other's tales. We are about to. And so thanks for joining us and also for submitting. So I'll tee up the bit now. Now we're all here. Let's talk about the stories we've got. And I've also got one submitted from someone else that I'll chat about in a bit. I think a useful way into this is specifically in a solarpunk setting, what's the hook that gets you considering the near future? And looking at all your stories as you kindly sent drafts to me, you've each taken a different implication of the climate crisis or a world in crisis and used a different starting point to go, what if? I love that. I also think, just as an aside, all three of you in particular on the screen at the moment have all picked teenage girls as your central character.
How interesting.
Yeah, and they're all three interesting, relatable characters. Like, I want to follow each of what they're up to. Why was that? Jump in. Why did you
pick
that?
We all have daughters, can I just say?
You do all have grown-up daughters,
yes. Before anyone else makes any other ideas.
Yeah, well, I think, I don't know, what is it about, I was a teenage boy, okay, but as a teenage boy, you know, you expect to do things like throw fur cones, have fights, all that sort of thing, all the things I didn't really want to. I like fur cone throwing, but fighting people, not much. Mm. So I wasn't very boyish at all. Mm. And I was un-tomboyish for a boy. I don't know what the opposite of that is. But but I've seen my daughter be quite a tomboy. But at the same time, there's something really interesting about a 13-year-old girl's mind. It's quite a bizarre thing for a man to understand, and I think it's so chaotic and fun. Or maybe my daughter is chaotic and fun and strange and curious and wonderful and hilarious, and I love all that. My boy is absolutely brilliant too, but he's a totally opposite type of person. In fact, he may be the type of boy that ends up in the story later. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know why. Simon?
I think it's because my daughters embody hope for me.
Mm.
I think that's the core element of it. But equally, I just think we men have just got it so wrong that that it makes sense to let the other side have a go and get it right.
Says five men on a podcast.
It is interesting. I've only just noticed the kind of mantle that we've accidentally got here, but we are talking about female characters as the centerpiece to all our stories. And that's true of the other story that I'll mention as well, written by a female writer. Andy, for you, this is very close to home. You've actually written something that is, well, where we have, just before you joined the call, we've been talking about consequences and how close to home the implications of solarpunk are compared with some science fiction and fantasy. For you, you've written, without going into too many details, you've written something very from the heart.
Yeah, my story is very personal. And just taking up the previous question, certainly we've all got daughters. I've kind of projected into the future, so I suppose my character is sort of female, young adult, as in the sense of maybe being in their 30s. So they are fully into adulthood. But it was interesting what Simon said with regards her daughter. Or his daughter's embodying hope. And I think when you've got kids, you can't help but project into the future, because as a parent, you're thinking, well, you know, are they going to be okay? You know, what world are they actually going to inherit? Because we just have to look at the headlines and just think, you know, how bad is climate change going to be when our kids are our age? And So as a vehicle to just project into the future, which a lot of science fiction is, just looking at our kids, or my daughter in particular, it's a very easy vehicle to just use to just move into the near future, because I'm, as a parent, I'm always thinking about the near future. And that's, I guess, where solarpunk is.
It's a very near future. Yeah, and I'm reminded that in the, although I haven't written a story for this particular project, I already had, which you guys have shared, you've read the draft for the script to go with my musical, The Shape of Things to Hum. And that central character, Jack, is also a sort of early 20s young woman trying to make sense of things. And I wonder if that's because there's such a sense of consequences more obvious to us as men when we look at women thinking about the world. It's good goodness me, they carry so many consequences. And the consequences inside men and boys is more hidden. And there's a whole story to talk about there. I'd like to get into our stories though, Andy, and I would observe that if we start with yours perhaps,
okay,
the hook that you seem to have taken, the sort of solar punk implication for you, I observe, is growing. It's the theme of getting to the soil and getting your hands in soil. But you've taken a really interesting take on it. What's the title of your story and what's the premise?
So the title of the story is Companion Planting. And to, I guess, to sum it up, to kind of give the elevator pitch, it's the story of a young woman who has spent a lifetime in institutionalized mental health care, who is gradually brought back into the world through the therapeutic power of gardening. In a nutshell.
Yeah.
I mean, we might talk about this in more detail. I didn't really dig heavily into the solar punk ethos. I kept it very light in terms of the content within the story, or indeed my sort of, I guess, research. That's probably shorthand for me being lazy. I'm not sure.
No, it's not. It doesn't read that way at all, of course, because it's you. It reads very intentionally. And to jump in, the whole thing's set in a, well, not entirely, but very heavily in a great big greenhouse. I can't think of anything more symbolic of solar punk.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, the one thing that is very solar punk is the idea of growing things, this whole idea of permaculture and allotments and growing things, which feature quite strongly in my story. I felt what was perhaps different to maybe other solar punk narratives is that rather than this just being growing for the sake of sustainability or produce, I've used it primarily as therapy. So this main character is growing stuff or learning or being shown how to grow stuff because the act of growing is a therapeutic process, but also it's a metaphor for parenting, and that's the other half of the story, which is to do with parents or the absence of parents in this particular case, and the fact that you know, parenting is nurturing, is growing.
It's replete with references and ideas. Lee, you read Andy's, did you? I can't remember now whether you've read
it. No, I haven't read Andy's yet.
Yeah.
There wasn't.
we can cut this bit out. No, but none of us have all got round all of it. I urge you to.
Probably working. Sorry.
You were undoubtedly working. I did think, there's so many implications to the language that you've used in this, the ideas and the idioms, but I thought of the current principle of digital twinning, but you were doing it in reverse. So obviously there's the idea of relationship, and I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but there's the idea in manufacturing of creating digital twins of physical objects so that you can keep the model live and you can test the digital twin of your real thing much more easily, and also feed live data into it to keep it. So, you know, you keep a twin of what you have in the real world going online for easier metrology and stuff like that. In a way, you were doing that with people in reverse. Instead of putting a real thing into a virtual world, your story is this beautiful coming out.
Andy's stunned.
I hadn't really thought of it in that sense, but yes, yeah. Well, I think this is a really fascinating aspect of literature, to which, by the way, I'm very new, because I'm a screenwriter and a filmmaker. So this idea of prose, being able to actually write what's in someone's head without having to externalize it, which is what I normally have to do. So it's a very strange idiom. So when you come at it with actually a quite new, different way of looking at it, I'm thinking, oh, is that my story?
But that actually is the
joy, I think, of writing in the prose sense, that it really does engage people's imagination in the way that perhaps sometimes filmmaking, screenwriting doesn't, because everything's very literal in filmmaking. You're presenting stuff on the screen, and so the kind of the wriggle room for interpretation is very is smaller, whereas in a book or a novel or a short story, you know, sky's the limit in terms of how people interpret it. There is that sort of twinning, that there's this idea of pairing, which is a quite a strong concept. Well, it is the nub of the story.
It's a lovely gardening pun as well.
It is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And what happens when that tie is broken, which is what the character is in the state that they're in. So, I'm kind of looking forward to other people's interpretations of it, really. So,
I found it very moving. It's beautifully poised. It doesn't read like somebody who's used to just writing stage directions between every line of dialogue. It just reads beautifully affecting, actually.
The part I read, I think you should do more of it. I really do.
Yeah.
I was quite taken aback. You told me that you'd never done prose before, and I was like, what?
It doesn't read like that. No.
I think we went for a walk a few weeks back, and I said, the last time I did prose, I was in primary school, you know, when you had to write a story in English lesson. And you only got 10 minutes to finish up, and you'd come up with something like, and then I woke up.
And suddenly this happened.
And then somebody who had that same name as my friend came along.
And so that is literally the last time I wrote what would be considered kind of prose fiction. Everything I've done in the last, 20 years has really been filmmaking, where it is dialogue, action.
I would say that your scripts read to me like prose. They're evocative, and I find, even when you're putting directions in, I find them a great flow to read. And this didn't seem weird. It took me a while to realize, this isn't, Andy wouldn't have written it like this before, because it is prose. It just felt like reading you as somebody who knows your work, which was beautiful.
Thank you.
Simon, I want to jump over to you now. Your lovely, a tee up to a whole story, really. It's a prologue, isn't it? You've done. I observed that your hook was weather, the implications of the weather changing. And you came up with a genius. What I love about your work, mate, is that you're all about the emotional reality, but you'll also hang it off a key napkin idea. You've got a great single idea in the setup to this that is fantastic before you even get to what the story title is implying. So weather was the starting point, it seems, for you. What was the sort of key idea, the starting point from you, from your point of view?
Paranoia, because I've got this central idea of the girl meeting this other. It's kind of funny, Lee mentioning Studio Ghibli earlier. You know, it's that whole Totoro dynamic of meeting this big, it's going to be a big robot, essentially. But there's something different about it, which I'm not going to say. But I felt like I needed to kind of plant it somewhere, which took me back to where the girl had come from with her little brother. So again, it's flipping Totoro, isn't it? Damn, I ripped off Totoro.
I did wonder that with the bus when it turned up as well. I just pictured the cat. I just pictured the cat bus for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, Well, there we go. If it's a tribute, then that's all good. This idea that they're coming from the city and they're going to move, because I was thinking about with climate, and I don't know whether this is scientifically going to be the way in the future or anything like that, but I just thought, well, if the summers are going to get as hot and as long as they are, then the first thing you do is move north.
Mm.
And I just thought that every summer, will they send the children away to colder climates, to cooler climates?
Frickin' hell, man. Evacuation. Evacuation is what you're talking about.
Except they called it evacuation. So it's
like you took the U out.
Evacuation and a vacation.
A vacation.
It's genius, mate. And it's such a great starting point as well. It's not just like super clever seeming. You don't do things to be clever for the sake of it. You do it for an idea. I know that. And this is a great kind of, oh, there's a... Because it does immediately make you think, what if we had to send the children away, just like in the war?
Yeah.
Wow, that has such impact on the idea of the implications of our time. Wow.
But I was thinking, would the cities then, for what they would be, would they be kind of the embodiment of paranoia, that people who've got themselves in cities have got this disconnection with nature and almost this paranoia of, you know, oh, I don't go into anywhere that's got mud or grass or anything like that. I like this. I like having all the buildings around me and things like that. But they become paranoid about the weather, that they're worrying about the heat. And obviously in the cities, the heat gets that much more intense.
Yeah.
And there are more house fires. And, you know, if there are epidemics, then it all transfers quicker. So you've just got this big ball of paranoia going on in the city. So you take these characters and then you take them somewhere where people are more in contact with nature and the pace of life is slower and they start connecting with these things.
So good.
Typically for me, who has written nothing but short stories, and then I tried to write a book and really struggled, this naturally feels like a book.
Yeah, it does.
So that's probably the direction I'm going to go. And I really wish I could have come up with a chunk which worked as a short story, but instead you've got the first few pages.
Yeah, and Erin is, you know, she's a foil for all of us, even though teenagers can be mysterious when you become dad's ages, as we all of us are. She's the relatable one who's most in focus in a way, because the parents already seem a little bit Roald Dahl-y weird and distant, because they're, that hint of paranoia, you're right, I can see that.
I think this will be a children's book.
Interesting.
In name alone, maybe. I don't know. But I really hope so. I really hope it works.
But Dominic, also, I'm thinking of you as a dad as well. How do you relate to your writing when thinking about your kids? Because kids feel such a bandwidth of brain. Where does that sense of future sit for you when you're writing?
Well, funnily enough, my fourth book, which I'm thinking about at the moment, is not for children, it's kind of for young adults, but I come at it with themes. So rather than a location or a setting, I think about the theme, what's the core of the story. And my fourth story is I want to write about late starters and puberty, because you know, I was a very late starter, my son is a late starter.
Thanks, Dad, for broadcasting.
We'll maybe cut that out. But yeah, we are so ingrained in our society of what's normal, but actually no one's normal. And have you ever met a 26-year-old that hasn't started puberty? No, it's just that I want to be grown up now. And I haven't seen any book out there which is about late starters, not with a hammer blow of, you know, you're a state late starter, but kind of intertwined into the story, a little bit like, you know, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, that kind of thing. So I'm debating, so when I think of, I don't really think about the future, if I'm honest, unless, you know, I had a specific theme. I'm more about, kind of now and how we can help people now. So my second book is about helping people who are in depression or, difficulties, and, how the community can help people get out of it. But can I just go back a couple of steps to Simon, what Simon just said, because it's really interesting about what I said about terms of reference before, because, you said about, evacuation or moving north, because in our heads, that's where the cooler climates are. But how do we use that? Instead of going north, because, you know, in the future, the whole planet's going to be hot. You know, where, what could be the opposite of, you know, going back again to Timo's speech of, you know, these are stories of, that we're telling, that we've been telling each other for 500 years. And, you know, when you're talking, I was thinking, rather than going north, like they're doing in Saudi Arabia at the moment, is they're going down, because that's where it's cooler. So the line in Neom, you know, that is about building cities underground, and there's already prototypes happening. Mm-hmm. Then what about up? Because it's colder up there in the sky, and cities in the sky. So, you know, I'm finding this fascinating, because not only you've interpreted the brief, but it's also triggering inspiration and stimulus, as we talked about before, of, okay, well, what's the, how do I take that and use that within my own writing, not copying or plagiarizing, but just thinking, you know, kind of having that spark. And we talked about spark before, and that's exactly what the festival is about. It's creating, it's finding the spark to help people to write. You know, the ethos, Andy, is before you, you know, the ethos of the Writing Festival is to inspire writers to write. And, you know, and what Timo's done very well here is say, here's a theme that you can focus on. But where I'm coming from is that doesn't matter if you write sci-fi or romance or speculative or book club, cozy, crime, poetry, doesn't matter. How do we find the spark to get people writing? And I think it's conversations like this. Yesterday I was on another call with Bournemouth University, who set out a challenge to men to write about masculinity. And it's so interesting because, you know, yes, it's very kind of very specific in terms of the audience, you know, of the writing audience, I should say, rather than the people consuming it. But what I'm finding fascinating of all of these kind of these groups that are forming, you know, outside or because of the Writing Festival, is I'm finding these sparks of imagination and stimulus and creativity to go, do you know what? I'm going to try this. I'm going to write. I'm going to put pen to paper. Even if it doesn't see the light of day, I'm going to give it a go. And as Timo said right at the beginning, it's about practice.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key to being successful. You know, as Andy was saying, you know, you don't write prose, but you do write. You write, you know, for a different audience, for a different genre, for a different way.
Yeah. But
it's still the practice, still the process, it's still the journey. And that's what we're trying to get out.
Well, I think once you're stimulated with ideas, then just follow it. It's having the confidence to follow that and say, what if? What if I wrote this down and didn't think about genres, but just followed an idea? Yeah. You made me think as well, with all our different senses of all our different experiences with ours and each other's kids, and our own senses of growing up, our different senses of, well, for the five of us, different experiences of masculinity growing up. A core principle of sci-fi, another one that I love, is that it's accidentally very hopeful, even in the most dystopian places, because there's a massive trope that everybody just goes, oh, yeah, that, to the science fiction bar, where it's full of massive diversity, where all these different aliens are buying the same beers, but one's got a big head, one's gelatinous, one's got a symbiont, some of them have got three heads, or some of them don't walk, but no one turns a hair. There's no fashy BS about, you're very slightly differently coloured to me, and you've probably got an agenda against me. All that's just gone, even in the most material badlands of capitalism in Star Wars, still everybody goes, oh, well, they're from that planet, and they're from that planet, and they're... And I just find that very image alone is a thing to get completely used to, that you do as a science fiction reader. You don't think twice about it. And that's life, gag, I would say. Now, actually, Lee, I want to come to you and talk about your story, because talking about richness and diversity, your story is typical you, because I know some of your work. It's so rich. It's got so many ideas and so many details. So you were saying earlier, I'm concerned that I might get something a bit wrong. And yet you're a science nerd and you fill this with world building and a fantastic title. What's yours called?
The Seed Pirates.
Get in! And your central character, she cries, oh, here comes the seed boat. Oh, what an idea! How evocative! So what's the premise of your story?
Well, I mean, she lives in a world of bartering, so it's we've gone back to bartering because money just you know, we're trying to avoid the capitalist thing, right? So I thought, well, how are we going to live? Well, you have to barter. Certain land will produce certain crops, certain things, and you can use things for certain other elements. You can make Hessian, you know, you can 3D print Hessian in this world, actually, but, you know, you can make Hessian bags, you can do eventually some kind of veggie plastic. It's 3D printing different types of vegetable oils and things like that. So everything is just, you know, brought in so they can just live and be happy. They're living in a community which is like a river community, so lots of little houses on the river, all square houses, all interconnected, with kind of solar panels that are also tidal, like a snake and things like that. I just overthink
love that
things,
image, yes.
But it's you know, how do you power this? How can you make this as environmentally friendly as possible? How can you make this the future? You don't want to make them cave dwellers. That's not the point. So they still have drones. They still have, you know, certain ways of walking through the nettle fields, because nettles are the most underrated vegetable in the world. We just chop them down. It's full of stuff. You know, they'll have entire crops that they will harvest it, and they'll do stuff with it, and then they send it back on another boat, and the boat will bring seeds to plant carrots and things. And if they can't do it in their soil, then the soil comes with them, and they can do a different type of topsoil or whatever. But that's kind of like the background of it all, and it's just really an adventure story about people who are just generally kind to each other, because there's no reason not to be. You know, things,
love that.
People's doors are unlocked, the seeds come through, they lock it in this really lovely kind of Norwegian style hut that's just floating on the river, and it's just left open because people can go in and they can share the seed, and you say, oh yeah, all right, Robert, yeah, you're going to do that. So they're just kind of sharing things, and then of course what happens is something comes along and steals the seeds, and this girl, everybody's horrified, like, hang on a minute, who would do that? They're just not used to the idea of, why do you need to steal it? We can barter it. Why would you want to steal anything? So yeah, the seed pirate's all about that, and it's the opening chapter really is just about the girl Gawa and her dad. That's funny, isn't it? Dad and a daughter story. And
another one, really.
Yeah.
Do you know what? Although the obvious word and the powerful word you've got there is seed, all the way through in lots of different ways, and that's the sort of the motif, if you like, or even or the sort of vehicle for the story. Actually, I think the what if, the kind of the climate trigger that was implied to me all the way through was sea level rise. It's all set on the water, and it's all the language of the water, and they turned it into something really positive. But it just felt to me like, oh well, of course, more of us will be living on the water in 80 years.
The rivers are obviously, they're going to be much bigger, and they'll be channeled a bit. You can do canals and things. There's nothing wrong with doing that sort of thing, as long as whatever's in the river is happy. The you know, the ecological kind of business going on there is okay. So the fish are all right. People don't necessarily need to eat fish anymore. They can eat other things. So there's all kinds of changes within the land that they're living in. But this is just one community. So in my head, you know, the world is big. And if you think about our world, you know, you have high technology in places like Japan and Britain and America, etc. And then you have low technology bases in certain parts of Africa and the deprived areas of the world. And people are almost just coming out of Stone Age man still. It's that kind of very, you know, it's no less brilliant, the life that they lead, because they don't need the technology, but we seem to think we do. So that's going to also happen in my story. We will have a city, but the city will be possibly a particularly obvious trope of solar punk with, you know, lots of solar panel buildings and trees and things like that everywhere, but it's not really working very well. That's what I'm going to put in there.
I was going to say, Lee, it almost sounds as though it's got a kind of a Mark Twain vibe to it, because you know, riverboats and adventures with kids on the river. Kind of evokes that kind of quality to me.
She lives in a world that I would love to have lived in when I was 13. So this is me projecting my, you know, this is the world I want to live in. Thanks.
This is interesting thing I wanted to say was that we've had this obsession with nostalgia these last 3 years, right the way through media, to the point. So I was thinking,
yes, it's a cancer. It's killing us, literally killing us. This, so don't look forward.
Turn it into a nostalgia that we've not had yet. So we create this environment that we kind of almost find familiar, but we've not got there yet. Or wouldn't it be nice if?
Yes. Yes. So, intentional dreaming.
Yes.
Yeah, which is what I think science fiction
does very well. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. How did you all find the world building aspect? You touched on it a little bit earlier, a couple of you. It's a big, as you said earlier, Lee, it can't just be a bike. It's got to be a very specific type of bike because it's all a signal about the. How did you find that world building bit?
Very quickly, because I could go on forever about this, so I'll be quick and let the others talk. But when I do murder mysteries and when I do any type of entertainment or any type of play that I might be in or whatever, or things that I write and produce, I tend to have a massive background for myself, and not all of that comes through, but it guides me. So that's what I was doing, was trying to create a world that I could balance myself in. So if I think once you create a world, you chuck your character into it, and the character has to work within your world. It can't work out of the boundaries, and then it's much easier. Whereas if you don't have that world yet and you're just working on a character first, it's like, well, they've got nothing to react against. If you haven't got a wall or a mirror or a computer, we don't know how they're going to react to each of these objects. Yeah. So by building a world, I know how Garrett already will react to everything in that world, whereas a dad may be slightly different to certain things, and people come from the city most certainly will be different to her world, and they will act differently too. But now I've got it, you throw your characters in, and there's only so much they can go ahead and do. They can't just suddenly zip into space.
I'd have the same instinct very much, I think, the world building bit. Andy, how did you, I know your light touch on the details, but it also felt a very present world. There was lots of implication to it.
Yeah, again, maybe sort of drawing from my sort of screenwriting background, I didn't do any sort of heavy research and have a detailed world in the background in my mind, in perhaps the same way that Lee works out a very strong backstory for himself. So I just found moments within the story that I felt could just give a hint of something. So, for instance, the main character who is institutionalized is in a room with that is featureless, but there's one window, and it looks out onto a landscape of green roofs. So, again, the green roof is a very common image within kind of solar punk ethos. The other one was when she and the other character are talking inside the greenhouse. She mentions that it's an old style greenhouse from a couple of centuries back, one of these endless hydroponic floors. Which
I like that. Just dropped in there, like it doesn't need any more detail.
Yeah, and you know, we're all sort of aware enough to know that the future of kind of growing food on a mass level is probably, I mean, it's already happening in some countries already, where they have huge buildings where each floor just has a hydroponics bed that, you know, goes on for acres, and it's under artificial light because you can grow more efficiently and much more quickly like that. And so that's possibly how we will feed. So that was the contrast I was trying to make in the story, that the feeding of the masses, you know, a whole city would probably be via something like hydroponics, whereas the allotment with less of a yield is really, in my story anyway, for something much more specific, which is a kind of a therapeutic end, and it's much more human in kind of scale. So so it just kind of fits that ethos of being nurturing and caring. I made a brief sort of mention towards the fact that UV levels were problematic in the future, and so everyone had to take a break from being outside after a certain period of time. So it was which just sort of, I guess, kind of obliquely refers to things like the hole in the ozone layer and stuff like that. So I was very, very light with it. To be honest, it felt like a story that could have taken place 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I really didn't want it to be something that felt very remote, because the things that sparked it are very immediate to me. So I wanted the setting to feel, you know, close to home.
But it felt the implication, whilst it's a very intimate story and very affecting for it, it feels like there's more world building going on than you've done. You've dropped these lovely seeds in there that feel like there's a lot more to explore, and yet you also don't need to. Simon, quickly to you before we sort of move into a few other thoughts to conclude. How did you find the world building bit? Do you geek off on that? Do you have a big map on the wall before you do anything, or where was the starting point?
I think I just started and let it go where it wants to go. I think as the story develops, I'll probably elaborate a lot more in a lot of those sort of things. Mm. You know, it is quite tricky. I do find that the trickiest part of this.
Yes. Why is that?
Maybe an element of imposter syndrome. Who knows?
That old thing.
I'm not very good at doing homework. I'm not very good at doing research. You know, they say write what you know. Well, I don't know that, do I?
None of it yet. None of that sounds like you, let me say, by the way. I think you do homework and all the rest of it.
No, I think I will just see how it builds. And what I tend to do with stories is I will write them, and then I will look for the connections between them. And I will find the things that make sense. And that makes up with that. And it becomes a mesh. That tends to be how my stories work, as I don't know what they are, what they're about, until I'm about halfway through them.
Yeah, you do. I've observed you do tend to live your way into them, and you've said to me many times you are one of those writers that feels the characters talking back to you and leading you in.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to share a little bit from before we wrap up. Hannah Hulbert, whose name is so nice, I want to say it in a French accent. Hulbert, Hannah Hulbert Hulbert. She wrote in to me and she said, "I'm sorry I won't be able to join the live chat on Wednesday, but I'm looking forward to hearing what everyone has to say at a later date." She's sent in her short story. She said, "Here are my thoughts on the processes of writing it." And up front, she says, "I'm really not cut out for writing anything set in the future. I've tried before and I just really struggle to make my brain work that way," she says. "All the speculative science in this needs a beta read from someone who can point out anything that stretches credulity too far." She's citing all the same fears that you've all said in different ways. She said, she feels like this has made her write in a much more philosophical way, and that's made her a bit nervous. And she said another struggle is that she said, "I was so hung up on the setting and the world building that the plot and character development took a back seat. I'm still pleased, but it's definitely not my best work." And then I read her story. It's brilliant. It reads like all the solarpunk stories I've read from you and from other people. It's called We Shall Be Monsters. And her starting point, I observed, was the idea of a fix for the climate crisis, then running amok years from now. And so she posits this idea of a fungus that was developed to eat non-biodegradable waste, and it's run out of hand and it's learned to eat everything. But the conclusion she comes up with this lovely sort of, it's not dissimilar from your tone of voice, actually, Andy. At the end, the conclusion she comes to with a sort of relational fix that begins to show itself between Professor Calvert and a very nervous kind of assistant to her. And interestingly, that her professor character, central expert, is an older woman. There's another bit of female energy going on there. And it just felt like a natural solarpunk story. Lee, this is one you read. Am I right in saying you read Hannah's story?
I scanned, read it. So I took it in and I really enjoyed it. It was like you say, there is this element of what you said, that she's just written this brilliant story, and I would never have known that she's not written science fiction or solar punk before. Right. I've read solar punk stories since, and they are really good, and the way they're written and everything. And I just thought, well, that's the same caliber of what I've been reading.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, absolutely, on the button. Yeah, it was really enjoyable, and the pace is great, and I just want it to be longer and bigger.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I could see that she was sort of wanting to get into character more, and she could. If this is a first pass, it's got a great central idea, and I wanted to build the world more of it. Andy?
Yeah, I did get a chance to read it as well, and I thought it was a really good story. I thought it was kind of quite unique. I mean, I haven't read a lot of solar punk stories, so I don't really know what's out there. But there was a really unsettling vibe to it. So the assistant to the professor, was it Vardon? I can't remember the guy's name now.
Yeah, Vardon.
Seemed to be having almost a kind of constant panic attack. He was really worried. And that sort of just really kind of I really responded to that, because he was really fearful for the future, basically, because he thought that this fungus, this out of control fungus, was literally going to eat everything, and that fear was very ably communicated in the story. And then there is this wonderful kind of fix, which we can't give away, beautiful symmetry to it, in terms of how it brought two disparate elements together, and that created the fix. But also running under this was this almost unspoken relationship about a son and a mother, which is kind of hinted at in terms of the relationship between Vardon and the professor.
Yeah.
But is actually speaking to the young man's own mother. And I thought, it felt very personal. I don't know if she's mining something that has happened within her sort of life experience. But I thought, that's interesting. The way that she's pulling these two seemingly very different threads together, a very personal relationship story and effectively an end of the world story, or nearly an end of the world story,
and they have very different attitudes.
Yeah,
they have very contrasting attitudes. Where she's the elder, Calver is the professor is the kind of elder who keeps her head. And at one point, she says to Vardon, "You're a man of science. Kind of get your shit together," is more or less what she says. And he keeps kind of externalizing, "But what if it just eats everything and we're all dead?" She's going, "Well, let's just work it out, shall we? Just sit down and work it." And then nature does sort of drop something in there, which I thought was a very solar punk detail, that nature finds a way. It's sort of one of the things I have hope in our times of complexity, is that complexity throws up mutations. And that's what life does, that anything complex mirrors a life system, that enough stuff going on for enough time complexedly throws up things you could not have predicted, like pandemics and lots else. And that there's actually some real hope in that as much as fear. So I thought they were very interesting contrasting pairings. You've described that well.
There's a really nice phrase, secondhand sunlight, which I just really loved. Bouncing off the solar panels, but secondhand sunlight. What a great name for a band.
It really was. Look, guys, we could talk for all night here. There's so many other topics I wanted to talk about, our ideas of how this makes us feel about the future. So maybe that's one last line from us all as we wrap up, is how this left you feeling as you look forward. As a writer who's engaged with a potential future, how did you feel at the end of a first draft that you sent in?
I felt relieved that I managed to get to the end of the first chapter. I think must be a book, to be honest. Like
Simon. It feels it, yeah.
Yeah, and how light, reading it back, how easy it is to read, which is what I was aiming for, without it being too heavy. I've done heavy writing before and sincere stuff, and I just wanted to not go there. So it was a nice read. I like to write all music or whatever, things that I would like to listen to myself. Sounds egotistical, yeah. But it's just me. I want to hear some ambient. I'll make some ambient, and that's
me,
what I
me
like.
Too. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So I kind of write the same thing. It's what I would like to read. I don't try and be anything else. And it was actually quite surprising reading it back, because that's literally a first draft with a few tweaks that I sent you. Mm. And that's how I tend to work, is put the pen to paper like Sam and just start and then finish and then go back and go.
But it's so rich. It's so full of details. All of your stories felt like you'd really done world building and thought about it. And maybe it's partly the practice you've all had at A, making, and B, science fiction, that you could do that with. It showed you've actually had a lot of practice, even though you all said, well, I'm a bit concerned about the implications. That's because you've got consciences and intelligence to not want to say something that doesn't hang emotional truth off it. But actually, all your stories felt replete, and Hannah's too, felt richly like this is a whole world to explore, to get out and chase these experiences down. Andy, quickly, what did this change the way you felt looking forward about anything? How did you feel at the end of it?
This was a different exercise for me. I mean, the writing is therapy in this particular instance, rather than, I mean, you gave us the brief, and that was my impetus to actually write something.
But it's broad.
Yeah, but what it did was it focused something that, I don't know, maybe I wanted to write anyway, or just take feelings that I was and am still kind of working through and give some shape to it. Does it give me hope for the future? It ends on a hopeful note. It's not necessarily a pathway to the particular future that is hinted at in the story, although that would be nice. It's a complicated one, really. I was glad for the challenge and the environment and the focus to write something to a deadline. I haven't really done a lot of creative stuff recently, so, you know, thank you so much for giving us this challenge and you know, just focusing my mind. I guess exploring something that is quite personal to me.
Yeah.
How it makes me think about the future, I don't know, is the short answer.
Will it make me cry? Will it make me cry, Andy?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it will.
Because you hadn't read it before this, wasn't it?
Not for the first time with my stuff, but yes, yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
You know I cry when I read your stuff.
Yeah, well, we all do. This will get to you, Lee, especially you know, knowing us all. And totally worth it. It's an absolute diamond, and it really is. And Simon, to you, I don't want to say a loaded question like, has it changed your view of the future? But I kind of want to know whether it has. Do you look at things in any way differently after this experience?
It's reinforced what my hunch was. I want to go back to something you said that Hannah said, which was that she felt like the character building and everything took a back step from the world building and the science, which was something I detected when I read most of the solar punk stories that I read. It felt like the this isn't a criticism, it was kind of the balance of the things that the characters almost felt second to the situation.
Yeah.
So I just felt like I wanted to write something where the humans were at the center of it. And what it has done is made me realize that, yes, whatever this situation is in the future, there will be human beings at the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling with everything that's happening is the one thing we need to change. It's all very well talking about all this technology. The one thing we need to change is us, how this works, our priorities, and all of those things. And that's what I wanted my story eventually to be about, is about that journey of thinking, oh, actually, that's worth absolute tosh. And that's the way to go. And actually, we can be quite happy that way. And that's the journey.
Mm.
And, so that has made me more hopeful, in as much as it you know, I've made that journey to a degree, much thanks to you, Timo. So if I can do it, then other people can do it. And if you can put that into stories, then I think it kind of, that's the sort of thing we absorb without even realizing when we read stories.
100%. You've summed this up beautifully, Simon. Thank you so much. The future is in our hands. You've illustrated it. Dominic, I'd like to sort of throw to you last as somebody observing a lot of this and who actually gave us all, me and all of us, effectively a forum to have a go. What are your thoughts after our chat tonight to wrap up?
I want to say, you know, that those last three comments are so pertinent because, you know, when we first met Timo and, you know, you asked me to give you a brief as to what this was and, you know, I was very much thinking because Timo's keynote was going to be on the last day, I wanted it to be about the future. So, you know, Timo said, go to my website, have a look around, and I stumbled across the blog, the planet is fucked, so what? And I think in the brief to you, I wrote a line that said, how do we as writers influence the future through positive everlasting change? And actually through this process and what you all just said was that as writers, you know, we talk about hope, you know, particularly when we're writing about the future, it's very rare that it's all going to end on a doomsday note. It's about, you know, a character having a problem and then coming and then being successful in that problem. So, you know, it's very, you know, to answer your question, you know, that you asked the guys just a minute ago was, it's very exciting, actually, the future. It's actually very hopeful, as you've all said, because as writers, we want to create a future which is positive and there's change and that we can all live happily ever after. And I think, you know, in terms of that one line of how do we as writers influence the future, you know, to make everlasting positive change, I think that's you, all of you three have just answered that question very succinctly in your writing and in through the process. So I think this exercise has been brilliant, and congratulations to you three and to Hannah, to everybody who took part, and to Timo for his brilliant, inspiring, energetic performance. It's actually, yes, we as writers can influence the future.
Yes, and we must, and we must.
We must, and we can. And, you know, there's a lot, you know, and you know, and a lot of the things you're talking about are so deep. You know, it's our human need to survive. And if we are to survive, then we need to make change. And it's our writing that helps people to visualize, I suppose, and to go into that deepness of how do we make that change? And I think these stories, I haven't read them, but I'm going to, is going to be hugely important in inspiring writers to, you know, set the future.
Thank you, Dom. Thank you to all of you for taking time out to write these and really throw yourselves into it, but also to be such great conversationalists around it. This is such a beginning of a conversation. We will have more. So I'd just like to punchline out to a funky jingle. So hang on to your seats, everybody. Dominic, thank you so much for setting this up for us. Simon, Lee and Andy, thank you so much for joining us. It's thank always you. An absolute joy, brother. See you soon.
See the future.
If you wrote in and were part of the discussion on the thread of the Bournemouth Writing Festival, a number of us were chatting on that thread on Facebook for a while, and it really got you thinking. I could see that. I really appreciate you taking part in that. This is a beginning. I want to encourage more and more people to have a go at Solarpunk stories as a device for getting you engaged with the future in a different way, because you are steps ahead of those who aren't practiced in writing, if you are a writer. You're used to trying to make sense of the worlds within you. You're used to trying to make sense of emotional truth. You're also used to framing the theatre of walking people through an experience of story. So if you can't do it, who can? So set yourself a task and have a go. And we're going to find a place to publish at least excerpts from these stories, and we'll talk to all the writers to have permission to read as much as we can put out there. I want you to read them and to see what it's like to try on speculative future fiction that puts real people at the heart of the potentials of our time. It's a huge vortex of possibilities going on at the moment. And half of that vortex is within you. But you, in that internal rich life system that you are, sappy old you all on your own, you are part of this big, rich, complex life system. And it's all one thing. Where do you end and life begins? It's very blurred, but you get to explore that and you get to share that with others. What a privilege as a writer. What a power as an animal to be able to do that. Go and do it. Engage with the future. I'm Timo Peach, which you probably know by now. I'm trying to do this myself with music and with a story around that kind of idea. And I am so engaged from having read all these stories. Just how floated I feel, buoyed by the potential we have in our hands and imaginations to make things out of nothing that can literally change the world. Bless you. Thank you for spending time with us. Get in touch at all the usual places, unseethefuture.com. You can find me and you can follow my work at momotempo.co.uk. There's lots of me going on there. See you soon and drop into the Bournemouth Writing Festival website, bournemouthwritingfestival.co.uk, I believe it is. See you around. Thanks for everything.
Discover more links and video and reading on the blog of this post at unseethefuture.com. And be the first to get the future in your inbox. Subscribe to the Momo Memos at unseethefuture.com/amigos. Listen, read, ponder, and share. Do. Unsee the Future is a Momo Tempo production. Obviously.